The Book Nook on WISO is made possible by 5 local library systems in Southwest Ohio: the Greene County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Midpoint Library System, Clark County Public Library, and the Dayton Public Library.
Good morning. You're listening to WYSO in Yellow Springs. I'm Vic McCunis. We have a very special treat coming up for you on the Best of the Book Nook today. We're going to go back to an interview that I recorded back in the previous century. It was recorded in 1999 with a man who is now our oldest living former senator. He was born on July 18th, 1921. We recorded this interview in 1999. It's an interview with the astronaut and U.S. Senator John Glenn. That's coming up in the Best of the Book Nook. Hello, welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. Back in 1999, I was here in the studios waiting for a phone call. And when I picked up the phone, it was ringing, and I heard the voice on the other end of the line. My heart skipped a beat because it was one of my childhood heroes calling in for an interview. And he called in about 5 minutes early. We were getting ready to go to NPR News. And I said, "I'm not going to keep you on hold, Senator Glenn, while we do this interview." And we went right into it with Senator John Glenn. He had a memoir out, and the previous year, he had become the oldest person to fly in space as the payload specialist on Discovery Mission STS-95. John Glenn was 77 years old. He'll be 95 in July. Here's the Best of the Book Nook as I spoke to John Glenn on WYSO. Good afternoon, Miami Valley. Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. And you're probably saying, what happened? We're supposed to be hearing the news right now. Well, we preempted the news because we have someone who's joined us by telephone that I think you'd probably rather hear than the news. Welcome to the program, John Glenn.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Don't know that I quite should preempt the news, but if that's the way it goes, that's the way it goes.
Well, you're the big news around here today.
Thank you.
How you doing?
Doing fine. Couldn't be better.
John, you've recently written your memoir, and I understand that your grandkids had something to do with this.
Well, they indeed did, and really, you know, I never planned to do a book. I think all these biographies that come out all the time, I've never been too impressed with most of them. But back about 6 years ago, our grandchildren were asking Annie and me some questions about what it was like when we were kids in the Great Depression and what it was like in Ohio then. And we were describing it, and we talked about it and decided that, you know, we should really get down on paper some of our family history. And so I did some recordings. This is about 6 years ago. I did some recordings, and we did transcripts off of them that I plan to just give to the grandchildren sometime, just so they'd know what happened back in our day. And then last year, after there was so much interest in the second space flight I did last fall, just about a year ago, that we thought if we could put this out, and if it could be an encouragement to people into areas of public service and interest in following what we did in our lives in government and politics and things like that, if this could be an encouragement for other people, then maybe it could serve a bigger purpose than just our grandchildren. So that's how this whole thing came to be, because I had never really planned to do a book. So I hope people read it and are interested in what in our lives, and maybe are encouraged into a participation of their own.
You grew up in a little town in Ohio called New Concord, and you start the book off by talking about playing taps with your dad.
Yeah,
and
right.
This is something that this memory returns to you throughout your life, doesn't it?
It does indeed. You know, New Concord, it was just expected that you were patriotic and that all the holidays were celebrated, and there was always a parade, and Annie and I were in the little town band. There were only about 1,200 people in town. It's a college town, Muskingum College, And that's when the students were there, the total was about 2,000 or a little over. So it was a small town, but it was a great place to grow up. And the highest thing you could think about back then was running for some high public office. That was something that you couldn't even, that was something you just aspired to maybe sometime in the future. But things worked out so that I could make some of those things come real, and we did. And I'll always remember those beginnings, though. I wish we had more of that feeling among people today about pride in our country and government, and not so much cynicism and apathy that we find with so many of our people, and particularly with our young people.
John, do you think if you'd grown up in a big city that maybe you would have turned out differently?
I don't know. You know, I couldn't answer that one because I really don't know. I think a small town is almost an ideal place for a kid to grow up because when we were growing up, you were just sort of had the run of the town, and everybody knew who the kids were in town, and there weren't the restrictions maybe that you have to have if you grow up in the middle of a big city. And that doesn't mean that there's any there are advantages to growing up in a big city too. But I think for kids growing up, I think you get a sense of independence and individuality maybe, and independence of action that you get in a small town growing up that is probably unique.
John Glenn has joined us. John, it's pretty amazing to read in your book how old you were when you met your wife.
Yeah. Or how young I was. Our parents were good friends and visited back and forth, and Annie and I literally were in the playpen together when we were little kids. There's never been a time that we didn't know each other, and so our parents used to kid us about how when we were very small, why they'd put us in the same playpen together, so we've been together ever since.
And if things had been different in your life, you might have ended up just being a plumber or a dentist in your hometown.
I could have because, you know, at the end of World War II, my dad only had a sixth-grade education, which was about standard for a lot of people back when he was growing up. And he became a successful businessman and later on was elected to the school board and was president of the school board and did a great job on it. But my dad had started. He came back from World War One, and worked on the railroad for a little while. Didn't like that because he had to be away from home too much, the far end of the line. And so he took up plumbing and learned that trade, and then opened a little plumbing shop in New Concord of his own. And the mother would tend the store while my dad was out on plumbing jobs. And when he had a full house to plumb or something, or a bigger job, well, he'd hire a few people, but it was never a big business. But he was very proud of it and what he'd made of himself, and I was proud of him too. And after the war, he wanted to know if I would come back and be there and take over his plumbing business. And I'd been flying for a number of years by that time, and going into plumbing wasn't something I really wanted to do. And Annie's dad was our town dentist also, and he suggested maybe I'd come back and go to med school and then take over his practice there in New Concord, but that wasn't something I really was interested in also. By the time I'd gotten that far, I'd been flying for a number of years and really loved it, and that's what I wanted to stay into. And I think they both knew that that's what my answer was going to be anyway, but it was good that they both wanted me to come back and take over their businesses anyway.
The Depression, this was a time that was kind of tough on a lot of people, and it really made a mark on the people that lived through it. How did it change the way you think about life?
I think it changed. I think it was an impact. Anybody that lived through that back in those days, I think, remembers it very vividly. And there were so many millions of people were affected by it. You know, it's hard to believe that we had, for 4 years, we had an unemployment rate in this country of over 20% nationally. And 1 year was almost 25%. It was 24.9%. Now, those were tragic years, and there were people out walking along the roads, you know, going places, and it was a time when the movies tell us about the Okies moving to the West with a mattress on top of the car and some of those things, Grapes of Wrath type things, and it was real. And I think when a lot of the thing that really was a pump primer that pulled us out of the Depression back then were some of the programs that Roosevelt put in. And I know they're very controversial still to this day as to whether the impact was too great or not. But I talk in the little book about one of the most memorable conversations I ever remember hearing of my dad and mother was one evening after dinner, and I was in the other room, and I could hear them talking in the kitchen, and they were quietly talking about whether the mortgage was going to be foreclosed. My dad said that he just thought it was a foregone conclusion. We were going to lose the house. Well, I'll tell you, for about a 10-year-old kid, that was a boy. That was tragic. I didn't know whether the family was going to be split up and where we'd go and who we'd live with. And then right after that, though, is when FHA was put in. And you could refinance the home and get a longer-term rate, and that saved our house, literally. So I guess I had that early impression left with me of some of the good things that government can do. And so I'm not a wild-eyed liberal that thinks government should take over everything and run the whole country, but I do have an appreciation of these things where programs can be put into play that benefit an awful lot of people and do an awful lot of good for people in education or housing or programs like that. And I think some of those early depression experiences of mine were things that stuck with me in my years, 24 years in the Senate also. I had a very small allowance from my parents, but if I wanted extra money, I had a paper route for a number of years and the washed cars for 50 cents a car and sold rhubarb out of our garden in the spring. So the Depression was a formative influence on me in later life, I'm sure.
And your dad, besides being a plumber, he was a car dealer.
Yep, just not long before World War II, they had what they called associate dealers then. And my dad decided that's something that maybe he could do because he had some extra space in the plumbing store we had. And so he became an associate Chevrolet dealer. And so I grew up when I was in my early teen years. He had that and the used cars out behind the building. And that's where I learned to drive, was shuffling cars around on the used car lot.
And you really wanted to drive. And in fact, you've had a real connection with machinery ever since, haven't you?
Well, I think I did, and I think that's where it really started, because working on some of those cars with my dad or work with the mechanic that did the work on them, working there, that really got me started on engines and was great experience for later in life when I was flying airplanes and dealing with the aircraft engines and things like that.
And you ended up going on some pretty interesting car trips, didn't you?
Well, we did. There was one in particular I talk about that was great because there was a fellow who was a fifth-grade teacher named Reese Keck, and he later was a teacher in later life. He came out, and I think he was a teacher in the Kettering schools for 20 or 25 years, and he died a few years ago. But he was a great teacher, and really had probably more influence on my young life than anybody except my own parents. And we had once one summer after I had learned to drive, he and his sister were going to take a trip up through New England, and they asked my dad and mother if I could go with them. And so I did, and I helped drive on that trip, and it was a great experience.
You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, an interview I did back in 1999 with Senator John Glenn. Our interview continues right after this. You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and we're reprising portions of an interview that I recorded back in 1999 with Senator John Glenn. The Best of the Book Nook continues as we talk about John Glenn's memoir. Those were really different times, weren't they?
They sure were. Very different times.
We had a president in office who actually was in a wheelchair, but the press never took a photo of him in a wheelchair. People had a right to their privacy that were in high office back then, didn't they?
Well, that's something that's certainly changed through the years. Anybody in high office now, whether president or anybody else, it's gotten to where absolutely anything can be taken out of, and there's plenty to look at on people that are wrong, but what I think has developed in to a high extent in the last 10 or 15 years is the press going into such minutiae and detail, and anything that quite often things that can be misrepresented will be. And I think that's too bad because it means people are discouraged from going into public life or participating in politics and government or even taking a government appointment they might be well qualified for. because they just don't want people looking into absolutely every detail of their finances and their health and their personal life and anything where their kids may have been out of line in any way or at all. And that sort of thing, it seems to me, we've maybe gone a little bit too far. We're discouraging good people from getting into office by just not wanting to go through all that hassle.
John, you were going to college when World War II broke out,
yep.
weren't you?
Yes, I was.
And by then, you'd already started to develop an affection for airplanes, hadn't you?
I did. You know, I guess my interest in aviation started back when my dad, one time, we were driving by a field in Cambridge, Ohio, a little airport, a grass strip, and someone in an old two-cockpit, open-cockpit Waco airplane was taking people up for rides for, I don't know how much he charged, but he was taking people up for rides, and my dad watched him go for several flights and then wanted to know if I wanted to go up. And I thought that was the greatest thing that ever happened, and so I did. And so he and I sat in the back seat of that thing with one strap over both of us and went up and flew around Cambridge for 15 or 20 minutes and came back. And from that time on, I really had an interest in aviation and built the old balsa models that you cut out with a razor blade and put the paper on and flew them. And they were wind-up rubber band models. And they'd crash sometimes, and I'd have to put them back together and fly them again. And then my dad was sort of interested in aviation, too. And he'd been over in France in World War One, and had seen some of the dogfights from the ground. He'd looked up and watched some of those things, and he had a big interest in aviation after that. And so every year when the Cleveland Air Races would occur, we went to several of those. We'd go up and stay all night and then attend the air races all the next day. And so I had an early introduction into interest in aviation, and it stuck with me.
John Glenn has joined us, and we're talking about his life. And right now we're just about in the early 40s. And John, I've got to say, when I heard about how you decided to go in the Marine Corps, I found that to be very interesting.
Yeah. Well, you know, the... I had my private pilot's license in college because it was a program, civilian pilot training program, that you could take, and you could also get college credit for it. And I thought that was too good to miss because to learn to fly was so expensive, I didn't think I'd ever be able to do that. But then right after Pearl Harbor, Pearl Harbor occurred later on, and I decided my duty was to go into flight training, and I did. And dropped out of college in the middle of my junior year to do that. And I went into flight training and then was out in the Pacific in World War II. But I decided in flight training I went through naval aviation flight training, which is where all Marine pilots also go through. And in the middle of that, there was I guess sort of the clincher was one of the fellows was back from Guadalcanal he was talking to us and gave a lecture to us, and from that time on, I thought I wanted to be in the Marine Corps and take part in that. And the Marines had a great reputation, and I wanted to be part of it. And so I applied and was accepted, so I got my commission in the Marine Corps instead of being a naval officer.
Now, John, wasn't another incentive the fact that you thought the Marines had the hotter planes?
Yep, they were. In fact, there's a little story behind that, too. The rumor was at that time that the Marine Corps was going to get P-38s, and P-38s was it was called the Lockheed Lightning. It was a twin-tailed fighter and a very fast airplane, and the rumor was they were going to go to the Marine Corps, and so a friend of mine, Tom Miller, and I went over and we signed up, and then later on when we graduated and were assigned to Cherry Point, North Carolina, Marine Corps Air Station, we fully expected to see our P-38s sitting on the line, but that had been just a rumor in flight school, as it turned out, and so we didn't get our P-38s. But when we went into further training before we went overseas, we were flying the F-4F Wildcats, the old Grumman Wildcat that people may remember from Guadalcanal days. But then that was replaced with the Corsair, and the Corsair is the inverted gull wing fighter that became famous in one of the TV series of Baba Black Sheep, Pappy Boyington Squadron. But it was a great airplane, one of the finest in World War II. And so we flew that for year in, year out, and it was a great airplane.
Now, John, this is really your story, but it's also a story of your enduring love affair with flight and with airplanes, isn't it?
Yes, I think it is, because I never got tired of flying. In fact, Annie and I still fly today. We have a little Beechcraft Baron that'll have pilot, co-pilot, and four in the back, and it's pressurized, so it'll get up to 25,000 feet if we want to take it up that high. But for years, we've done all of our own flying back and forth to Ohio, or about 90% of it, and anywhere I go in, say, the eastern half of the country. So we still love to fly. We've never gotten tired of it, and I want to keep right on flying as long as I can.
After World War II, you got your feet wet as far as flying and as far as flying those great planes back then. And shortly after, we had the Korean conflict break out. And this is where you really got your feet wet flying, isn't it?
Well, it is. The flying during World War II was where we were. I was in the Marshall Islands, and there were no other airplanes there that we were fighting against, even though we had the Corsair as one of the finest fighters. But it was being used for ground attack work to keep those islands knocked down so the Japanese could not come back in and reoccupy them again. And the people they had left there had all kinds of anti-aircraft, though. And that's what we were up against mainly. Every mission you went on, you were shot at with anti-aircraft fire, and lots of it. And I was hit five times then. Most of it was small arms, but one time was a larger shell. But you were not up against any enemy aircraft. In Korea, though, that was different. And we did ground support work with the F-9Fs, the jets by that time, the Panther. And we were doing close support work where you're down right in front of the front lines or knocking out targets deeper up country also, once again, against aviation, against anti-aircraft fire. But then I volunteered to go up with the Air Force flying the F-86s, the Sabre, up against the Russian MiGs, Soviet MiGs up along the Alu. And that was air-to-air work where you're being attacked by enemy fighters and you're defending or you're trying to ferret them out. Or what we actually were up there doing was setting up a screen along the Alu to prevent the MiGs from coming down and hitting our troops or from interfering with our aircraft that were supporting our troops down closer to the front line. So we would defend along the Yalu, and when they'd come across, there were some of the big air battles that people may remember from Korean days, and they were largely using the same tactics, air-to-air dogfight tactics. You didn't have remote missiles then that go out and do the job for you way out someplace miles away. You had to get in with the machine guns and get behind the other airplane and shoot at it that way. And so it was a different kind of flying because we were using the tactics of World War II, but you're using jets, and so you're flying now at jet speeds. And so you're flying maybe 650 miles an hour, so two planes coming at each other head-on were probably making over 1,000 miles an hour closure rate between them. So things happened very fast, but so it was a wild time for flying then, and it was the last of the real dogfighting, and I think we'll see in air-to-air combat. Now things have gone remote. You pick another plane up by radar, send a missile out there, and there may be some of the old dogfighting left, but I think most of that day's behind us.
My guest is John Glenn. John, these MiGs were actually coming out of China, weren't they?
Well, yes, they were. They were up beyond the Yalu in Manchuria, and they were coming out up there, and they weren't. They had been. Some of them, I think, were based in North Korea, just across the river earlier in the war. But by the time I was out there near the end of the war, they were coming out of Manchuria and up in that area.
And you wanted one, didn't you?
Well, yeah. Well, I had trained all my life in air-to-air combat, and I had done hundreds of hours of simulated air-to-air combat, and I think for a fighter pilot, that is the ultimate test, is to be up against another airplane like that and another pilot. And so, yes, I wanted that very badly. And so it was I was afraid, as a matter of fact, that I was going to get through without they had the peace talks going on. And we were flying right at the last part of the war, as it turned out, and I didn't know when the war was going to end. And so I want very much to get into air-to-air combat. It's something that every fighter pilot, I think, doesn't dread. You look forward to it at that time because you've trained for it for so many years.
And, in fact, you had permission to pursue a MiG into their airspace, but only if you were in hot pursuit. And
yeah.
At one time, didn't you like chase one clear to its field?
Well, that's the first MiG I shot down was one that I engaged. We'd set up this screen, and then you watched for a sun glint or watched for other airplanes and then you had to identify them because the MiG and the F-86 from a distance were very, very similar. The incident was the first one that I ever shot at was one that he and I got into it down low, and he headed down real low and started back across the river. Well, we were not allowed to go across the Yalu River into Chinese airspace and just look for targets. And that was very controversial. But if you were engaged and you were actually engaged in active combat with an airplane, and he decided to go back across the Yalu, and you were permitted to go in hot pursuit after that plane if you had already engaged him south of the river. And so that's what was going on. That was the first one I got, was one where he and I had been at it. Then he went down low and started back across the river, and so I stayed with him. And he was out ahead far enough I couldn't shoot at him for a long time. I was gaining very, very slowly, and we're quite a ways across the river, I think 35 or 40 miles, before suddenly he slowed down, just pulled the throttle back, and so I was able to close on him and shoot him. And he went down, and it turned out that right ahead of us was an airfield, apparently, that he was trying to get back into. So, but those days, you know, it sounds brutal, but war is brutal, and that's what it's all about. It's either kill or be killed when you're in a situation like that. And he was trying to get back in, but I got two more later on in other combat there also, so I had a total of three when the war ended.
You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, an interview I recorded with Senator John Glenn back in 1999. And at that time, he was still flying his airplane. Here it is, 15, 16 years later. He'll be 95 in July. I wonder if Senator Glenn is still flying that plane. We'll continue with the Best of the Book Nook right after this. The Best of the Book Nook continues our 1999 interview with U.S. Senator John Glenn. And John was talking about his wartime experiences flying in Korea. And he flew a lot of missions with a very special guy. He's going to tell us about it now as the Best of the Book Nook continues. My favorite baseball player of all time is a guy named Ted Williams. You got to know him in Korea.
Yeah, sure did. Ted's a good friend. I still see him. I stop and see him. He lives northeast of Orlando, or northwest of Orlando now a little ways, and I stop and see him every once in a while. But Ted and I went out just about the same time, and we had a policy back then that a regular Marine pilot who had been flying day in, day out for years, we would team a person like that up with a recalled reservist, which is what Ted was. Well, Ted and I were teamed up together out there, and you didn't fly every flight together, but if you were on the schedule for that day, two people were on the schedule, we always flew together. And so Ted flew about half of his missions in Korea as my wingman. So I got to know Ted real well. He was a good pilot, and he got hit several times. In fact, on about his second or his third mission in Korea, he got hit, had a big hit right around the engine area in the tail of the airplane. And usually on the F-9F, if you had a fire back in that area from an anti-aircraft hit, it would normally blow up and blow the tail off. And Ted, though, stuck with this thing, and it was smoking and fire coming out the back, and the radios were out at the same time. But Ted finally, he didn't eject, as everybody was yelling at him to do over the radio, which he couldn't hear. He finally came around and came down and couldn't get the landing gear down, and so bellied the airplane in and slid about 1,500 feet up the runway at K-16 and right just south of Seoul. And the airplane was on fire. He jumped out of the cockpit, ran off the wing, and stood there and watched the thing burn down. So, and he got hit one other time, too, when he was flying as my wingman, got hit by anti-aircraft, too. So Ted was a great pilot and did a good job. And who knows what records he might have had if he hadn't been called back in and been back in the Marine Corps at that time. And, you know, he had been in service in World War II and didn't get into combat right at the end of the war, then stayed in the reserves at the end of the war. And those two times, when he in World War II and in Korea, you can just, you know, he's still he's one of the greatest ball players ever lived, obviously, and who knows what records he might have set had he had those extra 4 or 5 years in there that he took out to be in the Marine Corps.
Well, you know, he wants people to say, there goes the greatest hitter who ever lived, and not too bad of a pilot from the sound of it either.
He was a great pilot, and I kid Ted a lot because he and I had a lot of wonderful experiences together, and he still, you know, he had a very bad stroke back a few years ago and almost killed him.
Uh-huh.
And he came back from that, and he's gone through a lot of therapy, and he's okay. He's out now, and he doesn't he's not running or anything like that, but he gets around, and he was at the All-Star game, of course, when some of the old-timers were introduced. And I was glad Ted got one of the biggest hands of anybody. He's a great guy, and he's come back from his medical difficulties in fine shape, and I get a real kick out of stopping and seeing him occasionally.
Well, I think that was the emotional high point of the All-Star game for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And I understand he's not a bad fisherman either.
Well, he really was. He's an avid fisherman. I've never gone fishing with him, but, you know, for many years after he sort of was out of baseball, and he managed for a while. He didn't like that much. And then he was he represented Sears Roebuck and some of their fishing equipment for a long time, and some of their athletic equipment, did a great job for them. And he had a place down at Isla Mirada, Florida, because there was great bone fishing down there, and he spent almost all of his time out bone fishing when he wasn't doing anything else. He's an avid fisherman, I can tell you, almost rabid fisherman, I guess we should say.
Now, you just mentioned how Ted had those very close calls with his planes getting shot up. John, you had your plane shot up a few times as well.
Well, I did. In Korea, once again, we were up against the anti-aircraft fire more than anything else until I was up flying against the MiGs. But with the Panther, every target we went into, just about, we'd be shot at. And I got my airplane was hit 7 times. And some of those were just single holes or double holes. But 3 of them were big-time hits from explosive shells, and I was just lucky that the airplane kept flying, and it didn't go out from under me, and I had a hole in the tail of the airplane once you could put your head and shoulders through, and another one on the wing, it blew a big hole through the wing. It was lucky that it didn't blow the wing off, but I think what it did, I was starting a napalm run one day, and just rolling into the run, and at about 8,000 feet, just rolling into the run, the shell hit and blew a great big hole through the wing, but I think the what had happened was it hit the napalm tank, and that set the shell off. If the shell had hit directly on the wing, I think it probably would have blown the whole wing off. But it exploded and knocked the tank off, of course, and made a big hole in the wing. But it still kept flying, and I was able to get back okay. But I was very lucky, very fortunate on some of those hits, because you can't. Now, you don't have any control over that. You either have control of the airplane after something like that, or you don't. And I was lucky that I still had control of the airplane. There was another one down low when I was shooting at an anti-aircraft position where I'd seen the firing. When I was in a bombing run, I saw the firing coming from this anti-aircraft position, and stayed low after that run, came back and was shooting at the anti-aircraft position itself. When another position across the valley was shooting at me and hit, and that was very lucky because the airplane dipped and almost hit the ground. So, and going very, very fast at the time. So those were times when anti-aircraft was some of the big ones that could have just if things had been just a hair different, I'd have been killed.
My guess is John Glenn. John, you just mentioned these rather hairy experiences that you had, and just by matters of inches, these things could have occurred. You strike me as being pretty fearless through all of this. What's your theory on luck? Do you have one?
Oh, I don't have any theory on it, no. But I'm sure good fortune and so on. I think a lot of times people sort of make their own luck in that they have trained a long time, and so they're very well prepared for anything that happens. But with something like anti-aircraft, there's nothing you really can do to prepare for that sort of thing. You can do some things differently. For instance, when we were making a bombing run out there, we'd come in high, and then instead of all just coming in from one direction and pouring in one direction, you if it was a heavily defended target, you would start a circle up high around that target so that each plane coming down making a run came from a different angle and didn't all come through from the same vector, same direction. So that would split the anti-aircraft fire up a little bit. So there were some things you could do like that, where you used tactics against what was going to happen. But once an anti-aircraft shell hit, it was just a matter of luck at that point, whether you still had control of the airplane or not. Unfortunately, I never had an airplane go out from under me.
Well, you made it through World War II, and you made it through the Korean War, and all through this, your wife was so supportive of what you were doing. Then you decided you wanted to be a test pilot.
I did, because, you know, I had been flying the jets in Korea, and we had a whole new series of jet airplanes that were coming into the Marine Corps and the Navy at the about that time. And I thought the best use of my combat experience out there, whether it was with attacks on the ground or air-to-air, there weren't a whole lot of Navy and Marine pilots that had that kind of experience. And I thought that experience could be best put to use doing test work on the new aircraft to make sure they were combat worthy. And so I applied for that and was accepted for test pilot school and then went through that for a six-month period. Then I was doing testing work for a little over 3 years after that. So, and that was on some of the new supersonic airplanes, Navy and Marine fighter and attack airplanes. And that was a very interesting time period. We had a great stable of airplanes that we were testing, and it was a very interesting time to be a test pilot.
And you ended up setting a speed record there at one point.
Well, that was right after that, the test piloting duty. I had done work on an F-8U Crusader, it was called. It was one of the best of our supersonic fighters. And I had done a lot of the test work, the armament test work on that airplane, firing the cannons, dropping, firing rockets, and so on. And so after I finished being when my duty time was about over for being a test pilot, why, I thought about trying to use that airplane maybe to establish a transcontinental record and bring the record back to the Navy and Marine Corps. The Air Force held it at that time. And so was able to sell that project, and the admirals finally agreed with doing it. And so we had this little project set up, Operation Bullet, we called it. And I used the F-8U and did three in-flight refuelings and flew from the West Coast into New York. And set a new. It was the first crossing of the U.S. to average better than supersonic speed. So it was a great project, and I'd love to go back and do that again today. It was a lot of fun.
And for the first time, John Glenn is in the headlines.
Well, I guess that's probably right. There'd been some press writings, I guess, back during the Korean days when they about some of the combat out there, the air-to-air combat. But this was the first time where there was some national attention on something like this, and I guess it was after that that I was picked up for that Name That Tune program when we were in New York, so that was another experience too.
And shortly after this, you get involved with the space program, the fledgling space program, and became one of the first seven astronauts.
Yes, as I was coming off the test pilot duty and was being assigned to Washington, I was in Washington at the time, and that's when they started looking for selecting the first group of astronauts. And we didn't know, you know, when I was a kid, there was no such word as astronaut, I guess. It had never been invented yet. If it had, I never had heard of it at that time. But they were looking for people, and I think they were looking mainly for military test pilots. And I had the experience they were looking for in the background, and so that was out of the 130 so that had the basic qualifications. The first seven of us were selected out of that, and so that's where Project Mercury pilots came from.
And they put you guys through all kinds of tests, and some of those tests took place just down the road a piece here. We got a lot of listeners at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base.
Yeah, we did an awful lot of testing out at Wright-Patt, I can tell you. And that was part of our selection process back at that time too. We had we went through the centrifuge out there, and they did psychological testing on us, and we did things at other places a slowly revolving room down in Pensacola, which would give you cross-visual cues to foul you up. At Wright Pat also, we did we were in a vibration chair that gave you different shook you at different frequencies and amplitude. We're in an isolation chamber there where there was no sound, no light, and just in the dark with skin sensors on to try and see what your reaction was to being in isolation like that. We had every psychological test, I think, that they knew how to give people back at that time. We went through an awful lot of tests there, and including some of the straight medical tests, of course, that we'd also gone through out at Loveless Clinic at Albuquerque.
I think a lot of our listeners have probably read the right stuff or seen the movie, and I think this book is your opportunity to kind of set the record straight on some of the stuff that people saw.
Well, in the I thought the book, The Right Stuff, Tom Wolfe's book, I enjoyed it, and I thought it remained pretty factual, and I sort of like his style of writing. Some of it is sort of stream of consciousness type thing, so I enjoyed his book. But I think when Hollywood got hold of that, and then they sort of made a caricature out of everybody that was in the early space days, and made sort of everything just got a Hollywood touch to it, and it just came out as not being the way they advertised it, which was as almost a documentary of the early space days. So I really didn't care for the movie. I thought it went far too far, and I thought the early space days were dramatic enough without Hollywood trying to ham them up a lot. Now, there have been some great movies, though. This thing, To the Moon, that Tom Hanks did, this series it was on, and that I think it was on PBS, I believe. And the Apollo 13, that was probably the most accurate movie on space that's been done yet. Jim Lovell's problems on Apollo 13, that Tom Hanks was also played Jim's role when they did the movie, but the movie was very, very factual. It occurred just the way it's laid out to be. Now, Jim's good friend of ours lived a couple of houses down from us when I was still in the program down there at Houston, and so when he got in trouble, I had left NASA by then, but I dropped what I was doing, went down and was in the control center there in the observation area for the rest of that time period, and I can tell you the way the movie portrays it is exactly the way things happened then, and Jim was one of the technical advisors on the movie also, so it came out as being an excellent movie. If you haven't seen that one, well, you ought to see it.
Now, John, in the movie, we see their version, and you refer to it in the book as well, all those temptations the early astronauts had and how you kind of made a stand and said, look, we're better than this. We've got to stop this womanizing and whatever else was going on there. Now, do you think this had an impact as far as you're being selected as the first person to go up from the U.S.?
You know, I'll never know whether that had any effect or not. But what happened then was after that sort of I wasn't trying to just moralize conscience of the group. What I was afraid of was at that time, with the pedestal we had been placed on, and with the space program not having universal acceptance back in those days, there were many people who didn't think the program was worth the money, or they wanted to see it done away with. Even some of the scientists, and a lot of the Congress had voted against it. And so I thought that one of the problems was since the seven of us were on sort of a pedestal, that if there were there was unfortunate publicity along that line, why we might have it might help get the whole program shot down. So I was concerned more about the program than I was about the morals of it. So I had we had an incident out on the West Coast where one of the photographers had gotten some compromising pictures and was going to publish them, and I was able to talk to him and prevent that. And so that's when we talked about this to the rest of the people, and it wasn't. Obviously, to be talked about in the group was not that popular. So I was surprised later on when Bob Gilruth then asked before the people were selected for the first flight, Bob Gilruth asked us to peer rate each other, leave yourself out, but rate the other people in the order in which you think they should rate as far as getting a flight. And so whether that had any influence on Bob's decision or not, I have no way of knowing. But I felt it was important for the program back then, and I know that some of the press has picked up on this and made that the big confrontation thing that I've made claims about, which I have not. I never made any claim at all that really had an influence on it. I don't know that whether it did or did not. But I thought peer reviews in that type situation where I had not been very popular because of my views I took trying to protect the program, I thought that that was, I just thought peer review was not something that should be considered in that situation.
Well, it's great to be able to ask you that question, John.
Sure.
I can remember a few years ago asking Buzz Aldrin if there was any chance that he could have been the first guy on the moon, and he had a great answer for that one. But it's just a real treat to talk to you. And this morning I was leaving the house and my wife said, John Glenn, John Glenn, John Glenn, John Glenn. That's all you've been talking about for weeks. I'll be so glad when this interview is over. And it reminded me of when I was 7 years old and you went up in Friendship 7, my mother said this almost the same thing. She said, John Glenn, John Glenn, John Glenn, John Glenn. Would he please stop talking about John Glenn?
I agree with your wife and your mother.
Friendship 7. That was really an amazing experience for you, I know, and it was, I think, for a lot of people in the world. And you were in a situation there where you had a problem coming back, and they didn't tell you. And you were a little upset when you found out about that.
Well, I was indeed, because there had been two indications sent down from two different tracking stations as I went around. Two different places had there was an indication that the heat shield was loose. The heat shield is held on by some latches that pull when you're down on the main parachute in the final stages of landing, and then that lets the heat shield go down and drop down about 4 feet on the end of an airbag that then acts sort of like an air pillow for when you hit the ground or hit the water. And the there was an indication that that had already occurred while I was in space, and that the heat shield was loose, so if I was going to re-enter through all the heat of re-entry, which got up around 3,000 degrees on the surface there and about 9,000 degrees off about 2.5 or 3 feet in front of the heat shield in this ionized layer, it would be fatal. I'd burn up. And they were talking about all sorts of things. Did I have certain indications, and did I hear any bumping, and a lot of things, but nobody just really came out and said, hey, look, we've had this indication on the ground, and here's what we want you to do. They were very hesitant about it, and I was unhappy about that. And when I got back, that's one of the things we straightened out, and it's the only thing I had to complain about, as a matter of fact, after the flight was over, because I felt that the astronaut up there should always be kept apprised of absolutely the last bit of information anybody has on the ground, every bit of information, because if you'd happen to lose communication and had to, back in those days, and then had to make a reentry, you should have all the information at anybody's fingertips. And they were worried that that this was going to be so disruptive that it might disrupt me. And I just felt that was, by the time you get through all the training we had and got up there, what you need to do to come back in is have straight talk, all the information that anybody has on the ground or up there. And so that's one thing that's been a policy ever since that time, is nothing is held back from the people that are up there.
You've been listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. That was John Glenn talking about that frightening experience up in space on his first trip around the Earth, and just what happened and how he was a little bit upset about it. And we were talking about his memoir, which came out in 1999. That's when we recorded that interview with John. And the year before, on October 29th, 1998, at the age of 77, he became the oldest person to fly in space as the payload specialist for Discovery Mission STS-95. John will be 95 years old this July 18th. He was born in 1921, and he was one of my heroes when I was a kid. And when I was preparing for that interview, originally he was scheduled to come to the station and do the interview in person, and I was very nervous about it. I went back into my stamp collection, and I found a plate block of Project Mercury stamps, and I put them on an envelope. And I wanted him to address that envelope and sign it but he didn't come in. So I was a little disappointed that I didn't meet him in person. And also he didn't sign my book because we did the interview on the phone. So I contacted his publicist after the fact and I said, you know, the thing that bugged me about the whole thing was that he didn't sign my book. And she said, oh, I'm so sorry about that. He's got such a busy schedule. He couldn't come out there to Yellow Springs. And about 2 days later, I opened my mail, and here was a signed copy of the book with John Glenn's signature in there. And I treasure this book. It has a special place in my library right next to the signed photo that Buzz Aldrin sent me, a photo taken by Neil Armstrong of Buzz standing on the surface of the moon. And that's one thing that I've really enjoyed about hosting this program is my ability to collect these astronauts. We've had John Glenn on the program. I did a couple interviews with Buzz Aldrin. And we had Gene Cernan on the program, the last man to walk on the moon. American heroes, these guys, and a vanishing breed. What a pleasure to bring you that interview from 16 years ago with John Glenn. Thanks for listening. For the Best of the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis.